Good morning to the world on this very, very rainy day. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
Yeah, but March showers grow April flowers or something like that.
Something like that. Of course, again, none of these sayings really holds up. It's like everybody says you eat first with your eyes about presentation of food.
Yes.
And one of the hottest trends are people going to restaurants that feature in the dark dining, totally dark.
Yeah, that sounds like a silly idea. Although I think the first person who ever told us about that was Heston Blumenthal, and he's not so stupid.
Yeah, I don't know if he said that in the dark.
There was music, I remember, and there were all kinds of other things he was
smells,
doing.
Smells.
But that's not what today's all about.
No, we're not talking about eating in the dark.
Funnily enough, our first guest, we have not met him in person. We only talked to them on the telephone, but I recognized him. Because
we did meet them in person.
Oh, that's right, we did.
At the James Beard Awards last year.
We did indeed, but most recently
he was making meatballs in the press room.
Yeah, but most recently he's been featured in some kind of menswear ad. I think it's Banana Republic suits, but I'm not sure which it is. And we forgot to ask him about that. So, because we were talking about something else, we were talking about meatballs. So let's go do that.
Yes, and Michael Chernoff, if you get back to us, email me about why you're featured in these ads.
And in the meantime, as I said, back to meatballs.
Now here's someone who's gotten an awful lot of media attention, and for good reason. Now that I'm looking at his book, we're going to be talking to Michael Chernoff. And his business is the meatball shop. And you have, I believe, three of those now, Michael, in New York.
That's correct.
And you finally put all your secrets into this, the Meatball Shop Cookbook, which is a delight.
Thank you.
I've read the book, so I mean, I know. But for our listeners, run us through how you came to decide that this is what you were going to do. Where did this concept come from?
Well, I've been working in this industry for about 18 years, since I'm 13 years old. And I've always had a dream and a passion to open up a restaurant. And when the time came around, the economy in New York, or the economy in the United States, and essentially internationally, was kind of on a downward slant. And we decided that we wanted to do something that was economically accessible to what people enjoy. And I take a lot of notes. And I know that everybody loves meatballs. So when we were conceptualizing, we decided that nobody's really executed a meatball concept ever. Meatballs have been on menus for many years, and it's a classic staple in most people's homes, Italian or not. People just love to make meatballs. So when I was thinking about what to do for a restaurant, I decided that we're going to take the meatball and kick it up a notch. There's so much you can do.
Now be careful. Be careful. Emeril Lagasse's going to sue you.
He's an icon for us, so, I quote him every now and again.
I see.
You really have taken the meatball to way beyond where a meatball used to be.
Yeah, we've been very lucky. People have embraced us. The people of New York have embraced us. I think what we offer is not only delicious food, we offer an incredible environment. We take the service very seriously, and I think the value is in the price point. You come into the restaurant, and you're able to walk out you're doing it for lunch for $12.
But you've got all kinds of different varieties. I mean, it's not
all
just
kinds of different meatballs.
Just your
we have around 56 different meatball variations. In the book, we have 30 meatball recipes and constantly coming up with new ideas.
Oh, listen, so I looked at that one. I just couldn't believe the Reuben. That's probably my most favorite sandwich, the Reuben. And you have a meatball that tastes like that?
We sure do. We have a meatball that tastes exactly like a Reuben sandwich.
I can't believe it.
We've tried to take all the classic staples and really put the flavor profile through a meat grinder and create our version of a classic dish. I believe every single culture has a version of a meatball.
It's true.
And
So
it's just the accessibility for us to create is incredible.
You know, you had a lot of fun playing around with the terminology here.
Oh, yes. That was one of the ultimate selling points for our original investors.
Really?
We sat around a table and everybody was talking about
balls.
Meatballs. Or if I could say it on air, balls all night long.
Yeah, you can say it because we're not FCC.
The FCC
right.
doesn't
do anything with the internet.
You, Just imagine you're with Howard Stern and you'll be in great shape.
Okay, great. Well, now that you said that, I'll definitely open up a bit more.
Now, you do meatballs, but the flavor is mostly in the ball. It's not like, I mean, Swedish meatballs tend to be extraordinarily bland, and what kicks them up a notch is the sauce.
Yeah.
Is the sauce a key ingredient in your meatballs?
Most certainly. You know, we have a number of different sauces. We carry 5 different sauces every night, and they essentially stay the same unless we have a special meatball that requires its own sauce. So we play around with a lot of the sauces. We believe that the sauces alongside with the sides and the special meatballs are really where the chefs of the restaurants get to create. Making sauce is a real skill and a real talent, and we have an incredible tomato sauce, classic tomato sauce.
Yeah, people rave about that.
We have a number of different sauces, but that sauce in particular was our biggest challenge when it came to the sauce roster, because I am a sauce maniac, and my business partner is as well. So,
and we should mention him, by the way.
Daniel Holzman is the chef of the restaurant, and he is my best friend and my brother and probably just about the most incredible chef I know. He just really gets it done, and he's started his pedigree at La Bernardin and worked there for 4 years, and he's incredible. He's worked for Jean-Louis Paladin. He worked at the Fifth.
He was in San Francisco.
He's all over the place. He's been all over the place.
And is he having fun with this?
Oh, he's having a ton of fun. I mean, he's been working in fancy restaurants his whole life, and to be able to do something fun, creative, laid back, low key, and user friendly is really special. When we finally made the decision to do this meatball shop, I saw his shoulders kind of drop, and we both smiled and said, "Let's do this."
Oh, that's great. And the photographs are so enticing too. Tell me about the Heartstopper.
The Heartstopper. Well, the Heartstopper, it's a meatball smash. It's essentially we have something called a family jewel. If you can imagine, everything
that's
that
funny.
We do at the restaurant is kind of a play on words.
I saw that.
The family jewel was an idea that I had, and it's an egg. And we drop a fried egg on almost everything that we offer at the restaurant. So the Heartstopper is a chicken meatball smash with mushroom gravy and a fried egg on top with mozzarella or provolone cheese, however you prefer. And we call it the Heartstopper because, well, you can read in between the lines.
now the funny thing, Michael, is that in Australia, where burgers are very popular, it's really essential that in addition to all the other toppings on your burger, you have a fried egg on top of the burger in the bun. I don't know if you knew that.
I certainly do.
Now, you have very extensive sides. Including really very wonderful fresh vegetables and salads. So you're also very seasonal, which is right on target, huh?
We are 100% seasonal. The only ingredients that stay on the menu that kind of counteract that is the spinach and the broccoli. I love spinach and I love broccoli, and it is a seasonal ingredient that we carry year-round because I just love it so much. You know, the meatball shop was essentially inspired to see a healthy lifestyle that I am a very healthy guy.
Oh, you're a runner, aren't you?
I'm a runner. I'm a long-distance runner, marathon runner, and I exercise a great deal. And I am very healthy. So for me, not only is the menu customizable at the restaurant, but you can have an overindulgent meal and you can have an incredibly healthy meal. It's really like a choose-your-own-adventure kind of place.
I'm looking at your collard greens. They're really Southern style with the red wine vinegar.
Yeah, we braise a lot of greens at the restaurant. We braise a lot of greens.
Yeah, you have kale with anchovies and garlic. Now that's really hot right now.
Yeah, a little anchovy sofrito. It's really nice.
What about dessert? That's another part of the story, isn't it?
It sure is. We wanted to do something for dessert that was simple, accessible, understood, classic. Just like a meatball, and we couldn't figure it out. It was, you know, we were going to just serve apple pie, and then I decided that not everybody wants apple pie all the time, and apple pie is seasonal. So what can we do that's also customizable that is easily understood, or as easily understood as apple pie? An ice cream sandwich. I grew up eating Klondike bars. Daniel grew up eating Klondike bars.
Well, you know, they started in Pittsburgh.
They definitely did.
Yeah.
So what we did was, you know, we decided, my wife is a pastry chef, and we decided to kind of tackle this ice cream sandwich and really do something that hasn't been done before, which was make your own cookies, make your own ice cream, and be able to mix and match and really create your own dessert. And it's been an incredible success thus far. My wife developed all the recipes for the cookies and all the recipes for the ice cream. And
wonderful sounding.
They're delicious.
Oh, they just sound heavenly. They really do. And unusual. I mean, not run-of-the-mill stuff.
Yeah.
So now you talked about customizing. That's another big point. Customize, you said, and that's another aspect here. You wanted a restaurant that let everybody customize whatever they ate.
That's a huge part of the concept.
And you give them a magic marker?
We give them a dry erase marker, and we have laminated menus. And guests really enjoy the interactive piece of the restaurant where they get to sit down and they get to check off what they'd like. And for years and years of working in restaurants and having people say, you know, I would love the chopped salad, but hold the tomatoes, hold the onions, hold the peppers, hold the capers. Decided that people honestly want to eat what they want to eat. They want to come to a restaurant and call it their own. And we've decided that opening up a place that could potentially be the kitchen for the neighborhood 4 days a week is what we wanted to do.
What sounds to me like you've done it.
Yeah, I believe that we have done it. You know, people come into the restaurant, they order what they want. We say no to nothing. We never say no at the restaurant, and people love it.
Well, now, I'm not going to put you in a corner here, but I can't help but mention, now you've opened three shops. This, to me, is a concept that really has no boundaries. You could take it anywhere. Are you thinking of that?
I believe that we are very, very happy in New York. New York is such a diverse town. There's so many different neighborhoods in New York. We have certainly made plans to expand in New York. We don't have anything set in stone yet, but we have certainly made plans to expand in New York City. And I do believe that the concept would translate in essentially any city, nationally and internationally. But for us right now, we're really focused on New York City. We get increased numerous times a week from people in Australia, in Hungary, in Japan, in China, in, you know, California, Chicago, Boston, D.C. I mean, all over the place, people want a meatball shop.
You'll probably get more of those because we have listeners in all those countries. So be prepared to get some sort of an inquiry in Mandarin.
Well, we better let this man go.
I wanted one question.
Because don't forget, he's serving 2,000 people tonight.
2,000 people at the Burger Bash at the Sobe, the South Beach Food and Wine event. But I had one other question. Is I just read that one of the big trends for next year are arancini rice balls, and you don't have rice balls in here.
We don't have rice balls. We really try to stick to the meatballs because that's what we're really good at. There is rice in a couple of the meatballs that we offer. Mm-hmm. We do a jambalaya meatball, which is made with rice, but we don't have any fried rice balls at the moment. But you never know what the future beholds.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. And as Peter said, you have so much to do. You're doing three different events, right?
Yep.
So, anyhow, that means that people recognize just how popular your product is and you are. So have fun in the sun for us because we're freezing our off.
You bet I will.
No, you forgot to mention that Mikey's calling us from Miami, where he's at the South Beach Food and Wine Festival.
That's right. Why
he's in the sunshine, and that's why he's cooking burgers for 2,000 people tonight. And it's a competition, and I'll bet you win.
If that helps us out, I appreciate it. I think that we have a really, really stellar product tonight. We're doing a chili cheese burger, where we've actually incorporated the chili and the beans into the burger mix.
Wow.
So it's not a big old messy chili cheeseburger. It's actually a very concealed chili cheeseburger. We have an awesome Kraft cheddar sauce, not Kraft like Kraft, but a cloth bound Kraft cheddar sauce, and we're doing McClure's spicy pickles.
Oh yeah, they're good.
So we're very excited.
We like McClure's a lot. Yeah, well, good luck to you, and let's do this, run through this again. It's called The Meatball Shop Cookbook, and it's by Daniel Holtzman and Michael Chernow. And when you're in New York, stop by one of their shops. Anyhow, good luck, and I'll read
Thank
about how well
so
you
much.
Did. You're going
to
probably
been
tweet.
Splendid and such a pleasure to talk to. I really appreciate you having me on, and we're just going to keep rolling balls.
I know a present I can send you. Something you can hang from your car, or do you already have one?
Oh, I know those. Those are funny.
Okay, Michael. Say hello to everybody
for us. Thank you. We'll do.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our next guest is One Girl Cookies. That's the company. It's a bake stores and cafes. And actually, it probably should be called One Girl and Her Guy Cookies.
Right.
But anyhow, it's a
It's really funny. It's not just a story about cookies. It's a love story, too.
Yes, it's a sweet story. Well, we have more from Brooklyn. The whole world seems to be centered on Brooklyn these days.
I know.
It's not the Brooklyn I used to know, I must tell you.
Are you from Brooklyn?
No, but I mean, I did live in New York, and I was frequently in Brooklyn, but I had a cousin who lived in Brooklyn Heights. But anyhow, this is altogether different.
Yeah, it sure is.
Now, we haven't said who we're talking to. We're talking to Don, is it Casale or Casal?
Casal,
and David Crofton, and you are proprietors of One Girl Cookies Bakery in Brooklyn, New York.
Exactly.
Yes, and how old is this?
The business? Well, I started the business going on 12 years now.
That's a long time.
Yes, sure is.
So you were ahead of the curve in terms of the popularity of what do you do here? You do cakes, cupcakes, whoopie pies, cookies, but you were way ahead of the curve.
Yeah, we were. When we started, it was really just small tea cookies that grew and evolved, and we added to our offering along the years, through the years. And so now, yes, we do cakes and cupcakes and whoopie pies and even wedding cakes and special event desserts and things like that. So, yeah, we were doing, I think it's safe to say we were doing whoopie pies before anyone else in this area anyway was doing them.
Well, now you have a number, I think they're Dawn's family photographs in this book. Is there a big influence from your family and your recipes?
Yeah, well, the recipes now, they have really, I started the business on my own 12 years back, and those recipes were mine, and they were, if not family recipes, inspired by family recipes. And then Dave has, joined me in the business a few years later and has now really made the recipes his own. But to answer your question, yeah, my family played a very big role in why I became involved in the food world.
Yeah, well,
and so that was how I honored them, by putting their photos on the boxes. And then now there are photos of both of our families in the book.
Uh-huh. Now, the style of these, first of all, I think that it's totally appropriate to have these empty wrappers. What do you call them? Cupcake wrappers?
Yeah.
Because these are just so good. I mean, they look so good. I haven't tasted any, but they sure look good. And we're talking about your sharing now all these wonderful recipes, and they are delicious sounding, through a cookbook called One Girl Cookies. And they're all doable recipes, aren't they?
The recipes are approachable to any level of baker. There are some of the cake recipes in the book have a few challenging elements to them, such as candied orange zest or a hand-stirred caramel, but those shouldn't be intimidating for people that have just started baking, and if you're really a novice, some of the cookie recipes and the whoopie pie recipes are very straightforward and really a lot of fun bake alone or with a group of people. It's intentionally an approachable cookbook that people can really dig their teeth into.
Now, There's another story here that we should be telling, is that you present this whole collaboration as a love story. Tell us about that, Dawn.
Well, it's true, yeah. So I had been working out of my apartment and running my business out of the apartment, and at some point I came to this realization that the business was always going to be stifled by the size of my apartment. So I really needed to give it some room to grow, and I started renting kitchen space. And with that did come some growth of the business, which was really great, but I realized that I needed some help and that it couldn't really be one girl anymore. So I started putting out the word that I needed a baker, and a friend said, hey, you know, I work with a guy, he's going to pastry school at night, and he's looking for a job, he's about to graduate. Do you want to speak to him and interview him? And I said, sure, why not? So,
yeah, he's cute. David, you're cute.
Long name, Dave Crofton.
So you hit it off, apparently, huh?
We sure did.
But it wasn't straightforward, though. He left for another job, right?
He did. That scoundrel, yes. He did. We were working together, and it really was a professional relationship. Slowly but surely, there was some flirting happening, but we were really just working together. And then we started talking about him becoming a partner and things becoming more serious, both personally and professionally, until he literally floored me by telling me that he was leaving and going to work at a new restaurant that was opening up. And it was a much more glamorous job, he thought. So he left.
What a scoundrel.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Well, yeah. If I may defend myself for a moment, I was approached by somebody and I felt it wasn't a problem to speak with them, and they really offered me a very exciting job in a new high-profile pastry kitchen of a restaurant, and it was a great opportunity, and really it was sort of my dream job that was handed to me on a silver platter, and I had real thoughts about Dawn and the cookie shop, and we all make mistakes, but it's how we go about rectifying those mistakes that are really the measure of a man. And so after 2 weeks, literally after 2 weeks, I decided that I had made a mistake and I really wanted to be with Dawn and with her company.
Oh, that's
and
great.
So I begged her and she was gracious enough to let me back in the door.
Well, this is wonderful.
But she probably never let you forget it, right?
Well, here we are. The story still comes up, and it's been 8-9 years, so.
Well, when I started out saying you're way ahead of the curve, I mean, the pastry chefs have really come into their own now. Food and Wine, for the first time in its history, sponsored a contest for picking the best new pastry chefs in the whole country. And it's just, it's become a status thing. A lot of male pastry chefs, too, I might say, which is interesting because it used to be a female position, pretty much.
Right.
Yeah, so, and we have all these high-profile things. I mean, everybody holds their breath about where Michael Lascaunis is going next and where Johnny Unis
is. Right.
Yeah.
So, and it's, there are more bakeries. I mean, I have personal friends that have opened bakeries, and they're doing well, but at some point the competition is going to be really extreme. What's your read on where we're going with all this?
It seems, right now it's a great thing. There was a time when there were precious few bakeries, the old days of the mom and pop bakery that had great bread and cupcakes and cookies on every corner in every neighborhood, had sort of fallen by the wayside. And I think this renaissance of small artisanal bakeries is a beautiful thing. And whether people are baking baguettes or croissants or cupcakes and whoopie pies, I think it's a good thing for neighborhoods to have a local bakery. I think fresh bread and fresh baked goods are a great thing to have around the house. I think it's much better to dig into a fresh cookie from your local bakery than it is to buy something at the grocery store that you don't know where it came from or when it was baked. So I think that's a good trend that's happening right now. As far as the superstar status, I think it's also a good thing. People, it's a lot of work to be a baker, to be a chef, and it's great that folks are being acknowledged for that work that they've put into their careers. And it's a very satisfying career. It's really pretty nice to see people that say, oh, I had your cake at a birthday party. It was incredible. Yeah, that makes you feel good. And I think it's also a nice part of a meal. And it's, you know, the dessert is oftentimes the thing that people remember. And so that positive impact on the meal is reflected in that popularity of those chefs. Neil, you remember it.
Now, there's something else going on here, though, because the reason that we hooked up with you for today's interview is that you decided to give all your secrets away. So there is another way of producing desserts and baked goods, and that's to make them yourself. And you didn't mention that, but what do you think about that, Dawn?
About making desserts yourself?
Obviously, you think people will want to, otherwise you wouldn't have published this beautiful cookbook.
Yeah, I think actually there's a really terrific new movement in food and people being more involved in what they're eating and where it comes from, and whether that means making it themselves, or if it means just knowing where it was grown or where the animal came from or the ingredients that are going into it. And I think that's a very positive thing in a number of different ways. So, yeah, I mean, people really like to bake. And I think baking has become so much sexier than it ever used to be, not just for grandmas making chocolate chip cookies anymore. I think that baking, people are really embracing the process of baking and the precision that's involved in it. And we get requests and questions all the time about, you know, what's the proper way to do this? And we hold classes at our shop, and we sell out almost every month because I think people have this real interest in learning how to do it.
Now, you have a lot of Sicilian-style recipes in here, which I just love, including...
Yeah, I saw your site.
Yeah. But the sfinge, the donut holes, they're rather special, aren't they?
Oh, my goodness. They are terrific.
Yeah, I have not had one of those since my grandmother died.
Well, now you have a recipe. It may not be exactly like your grandmother's, but maybe you can do some tweaking so that it ends up sort of like what she would make. They are so delicious. And the ironic thing is, you know, my mom's side, my mom was born in Sicily, and a lot of my culinary influence definitely comes from that side of the family, I would say. My dad's side is also Sicilian, but from a few generations ago, and definitely a little bit more Americanized. But that particular recipe happens to be my paternal grandmother's recipe. And it is one of the few things in her repertoire that really, it was terrific. She was not the greatest cook, but she did make sfinge. And the honey at the bottom of the bowl, as I mentioned in my head note, was literally, we would clamor for those last drops of that honey.
I don't think I've really emphasized this enough. This is not only an exciting cookbook. These recipes are absolutely yummy, like mascarpone and fresh fig tart with cornmeal crust. It's this, and you will even make, you have the maple pecan pie, which is totally decadent, tarts, the cupcakes, of course, and you mentioned whoopie pies, hazelnut brittle. I mean, you do homemade marshmallows, yogurt. I mean, this is a really, it's not a big, fat, heavy book, but it certainly covers a lot of ground. Yes.
Yeah.
You say yes?
You know, it does, and that's, you know, it was, we wanted the book to really be a reflection of our shop, and so although there are not certain things that are in the book we don't make at our shop, like the family, most of those family recipes. But that's strictly for out of practicality. They involve frying or some other things that don't make it practical from a business perspective. That being said, because our families play such a large role in why we got involved in food and in our brand, it still has a relationship to our shop, the family chapter. And then many of the other things that are in the book are things we do serve breakfast, and we wanted to share those items, the yogurt and the muffins and scones, et cetera, with everybody. So it really was a way for us to share our shop, kind of get it to extend across the country, and so that people that may not be able to come in every day can still have that One Girl Cookies experience.
You don't internet sell?
We do. Not everything that we make, but we do ship our cookies and our whoopie pies across the country in lovely gift boxes.
Now, you mentioned a little bit ago that you also answer questions. Is that something else that people can do through your website?
Certainly. We get asked a lot of questions, and particularly since the book came out, folks will, whether it's a comment or a question, folks will either email us or call us, and we love it. It's an interaction. I love to try to help people solve problems.
Now, where should those inquiries be directed so that listeners will know?
If you look at our website, www.onegirlcookies.com, that's all spelled out, .com.
Okay, that's the place where people can go.
Or send us an email. I'm sorry?
So that's the place where people can go. Well, they can send an email to
info, info@onegirlcookies.com. And we usually try to respond right away because there are questions that come up. People come up with good questions and real issues and stumbling blocks. And usually it's just one little piece of information and then they're able to master a recipe. And so we're glad to help people out with any problems that might come across.
Well, that's very kind and generous of you, and you can be sure that Ann and Peter will probably take advantage of that just like everybody else will.
I don't want to do that. I want them to send me all kinds of good stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
The almond spirals.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So if people are friending us on Facebook, which we're encouraging everyone to do, obviously, but people that have purchased the book, that is a way that they will be disseminating information about the book. So if somebody has an experience with a recipe, what type of flour, or they made a substitute that either worked or didn't work, that is the place. That's another forum through which they can get some information about the recipes and other people's experiences with them.
Well, I just want to be your best friend. Would that work?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. We just opened up a second cafe in a different part of Brooklyn, and one of the things that does happen is when we have leftover cupcakes, we bring them over to the neighboring businesses.
Oh.
And so I think it makes us good neighbors, if not good friends. But I love the look on people's face when they're just finishing up after a long day, and I come up and I say, "We have a dozen extra cupcakes. Would you like them?" And it's like a trick question. Yes, I will take those 12.
Yeah, Lori Greenspan swears that anybody who works in her house is delighted because she always tips them sort of with her baked goods.
This is called bribery.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. In some cultures.
Well, I just think it's a wonderful book, and it's a nice story and delight. It was a delight to talk to you. And thanks for bringing up the second location, because I did read that. And so I knew you had more than one location here. So keep up the good work.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for having us.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Oh, yes. I'm delighted.
And we'll take another break, but we won't be long.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again. I bet you never thought that cupcakes had genders.
No, I bet you didn't.
But David Arick figured this out, and he's also one of those second career persons, a former actor and lawyer. But now he has this company called Butch Bakery.
And it's really funny because the Butch Bakery isn't operating right now, but we hope it will be again soon, and we've heard it is.
Yeah.
So in the meantime...
But he has a book.
And in the meantime, he decided to share all his secrets, and it's a fascinating story as to why he thinks that that's not going to interfere with the success of his Butch Bakeries when they get running again. So altogether, a very, very interesting interview with a very interesting guy.
David Arick, you've done so much in your life. I somehow find it difficult to call you a cupcake entrepreneur, but I'm looking at this book that you wrote, and it's called The Butch Bakery Cookbook. And how you describe yourself is as a cupcake entrepreneur.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, but the whole point of this cookbook is, in fact, that you got tired of this image of frilly, cutesy, pastel-colored, glittery cupcakes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Aren't we all? Aren't we all a little tired of that?
I'm a little tired of it, but
yeah.
At any rate, I love your recipes in this. But let's describe... It's hard to really imagine all the things you've done. In the past, you were an actor, a personal trainer,
yeah.
A lawyer on Wall Street,
yeah.
And then the cupcake entrepreneur.
And now this, yeah, I've got 9 or 10 or 15 lives. I keep coming back and reinventing myself, and that's the name of the game for me. It keeps me going, it keeps me jazzed, and I love it. I love the reinvention aspect, and I love being creative, and this was a creative venture for me. It was just the next step in my evolution here.
Was it a hard decision?
It wasn't a hard decision. I think that necessity is the mother of all invention, as they say, and I'm a direct casualty, if you will, of the recession. I needed to do something, and I looked around, and I thought, let me do something that's resonating now, in spite of the recession. And what is that? It's cupcakes. And I always had a passion for cooking and baking. And I thought, let me use a little bit of my skill and take some of my avocation and my passion and put it to good use. So it wasn't necessarily a surprise to me that it would be the next thing that I would create. It was organic for me.
Well, how about describing what's in this book, The Butch Bakery? Now, the Butch Bakery is temporarily closed and will reopen, but the book we're talking about now, what is different about this concept?
Well, the book conceptually, The Butch Bakery, I thought, let me do something that's different from the name of the company to the type of cupcakes to the marketing of this company. What type of cupcakes are going to be different? But we have to do something that's different without pink, frilly, unicorn-topped pink, purpley buttercream. I don't know. I just got tired of seeing that. So I thought, let me go the direct opposite direction. And let me make cupcakes perhaps with beer. Or let me make cupcakes with whiskey. Let me make cupcakes with cayenne pepper. Very bold flavors, ginger, things that I love and things that, I don't know, I called them guy-friendly, but they're certainly girl-friendly as well. But I wanted to market this in a very specific way. I consider myself a nichepreneur. I call myself a nichepreneur, so I identified my niche market, and it was guys. And how was I going to make this guy-friendly? And I thought, they got to look guy-friendly. They got to taste guy-friendly. And that's what I did. So I decided to use ingredients that I called masculine, I called unconventional, that I deemed bold, and that's what we did.
Dude-friendly flavor.
Dude-friendly, yeah. But they're girl-friendly, too. Come on, you like them.
Yeah, I mean,
you're a girl.
I've attempted to make some of these, actually.
I hope you do.
Yeah, some of them look tough, though.
Some of them look tough. Yeah, coffee cupcake is pretty tough. The beer cupcake is pretty tough. The Jack Daniels cupcake is super tough.
Yeah, but one of the things you've done in the beginning chapters of the book, you really explain how it's done. So, you know, what tools you need, what ingredients you need, everything to get yourself set up properly to be a sort of an amateur cupcake champion.
I think that's
right. Is in that book.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You don't have to be an expert. You don't have to go to culinary school or baking school. You know, we spell it out for you, and we give you what's called a plan of attack.
Yes, you know, I like that, yeah.
Yeah, and we give you an ingredient roster.
Yeah.
You get it?
Yes.
It all goes to the concept and the marketing of the business. And that was really important. To tell you as sort of a sideline here, when I started the company and started developing the book and all the ideas and the recipes, I had a lot of naysayers left and right saying, no, you have to do this. You have to make a red velvet cupcake this way. You have to do a simple vanilla buttercream this way. You have to, you know, because everyone else is doing it. And I thought, if I listened to all those naysayers and I listened to all the people who were trying to pull me down the traditional pathways, I wouldn't have made it here. And thus far. And that's just something that I learned early on as an entrepreneur. True to what your vision is and what your heart is telling you and what your eye is telling you is keep your eye on the goal.
Now, what is the timing of this? When did you decide to open the bakery?
Yeah, in 2009.
Okay.
2009.
So that was, cupcakes were really hot then.
Yeah, they're still hot. And, you know, I can tell you that I, they're in New York City, and there's a cupcake shop and a new bakery opening on every block.
And they still have lines around.
They still have lines around the block. And ask yourself, what are they doing that's so different than the next? And that's what I thought. I had recently been laid off. I'd never been laid off in my life. I'd always worked since I was 16 years old. And I thought, what am I going to do now? And I looked and saw that people were opening up bakeries. It was very friendly to the recession. People enjoyed a sweet treat. It made them feel good. It was cost effective. And I just thought, let me try this, but let me do it differently. And I wasn't going to do it differently and just call it different like everyone else was calling. These are different because they're my grandmother's recipes. These are different because it's a different kind of vanilla. I mean, you know, I thought, let me really do it different. If I'm going to do this, let me make it 100% different, really, really different, and really bold, or else it wasn't going
to
work.
To sell a lot of cupcakes to live in New York.
You do.
Yes.
You do.
So what are you doing when the bakery's closed? You don't do pop-ups?
I did a couple of pop-ups. I did some great parties for the UGG company, for the UGG booth. I do different, you know, I get called from the Food Network. I'm actually doing a little bit of work with Mark Summers from the Food Network, and we're trying to develop this into a show. of some sort. Do hits every now and then. We've done a couple of pop-ups. We're trying to decide what our goal now, though, now that I'm working on my with my investors, the goal is to open up a couple of shops simultaneously in New York and a couple of other cities. Based on the response that the book has gotten and the marketing and the response globally that I've gotten, I realize now that this is not just a New York-friendly concept. This concept is working in Japan, New Zealand, Australia, Israel, Brazil, Canada. I get requests from all around the world from entrepreneurs who want to open up their own Butch Bakery shop in their town. And I just knew that I was onto something
global. So you're going to franchise this?
Yes, that's the idea. Yeah, that's the goal.
So you're going to really jump right into the middle of a business empire.
We're going to jump right in. And what I'm interested in doing is I'm really a fan of branding, companies that take brands and really exploit it and take it nth degree. I'm a huge fan of that. Really seeing, really uncovering, turning over every rock. What can you do here? How can I develop this brand beyond cupcakes? Cupcakes was the springboard and will always be the initial springboard, but it's going to catapult into something else. And that's my goal.
That's really fascinating. Now, you're not afraid that selling the book, you're giving all your secrets away?
I'm not at all.
Because you'll just keep on moving on, right?
Just keep on moving on. And I love my recipes, and I love the ideas, and I love the flavor profiles, but there's a lot of them out there. And what's great about the book is that we give about a half page on every recipe for you to tweak the recipe and to make notes as well as you go. How many cookbooks do I have that I've written in the margin?
Yes.
Or have a post-it, right? And so we thought that was a great idea. People would love that, and people seem to love that idea.
Well, the book is called
The Butch Bakery Cookbook. The cupcake entrepreneur is David Arick, A-R-R-I-C-K,
Before we came on the air, David promised he would get back to us and let us know when the Butch Bakery is going to open again.
Absolutely.
Which is going to be just 2 or 3 months from now. So, David, we'll welcome you back then, and we'll find out what else you've been up to. I'm sure you probably have done 3 or 4 other new things by then.
And in the meantime, people could satisfy their sweet tooth with this cookbook.
That's right. Thanks so much.
Look forward to talking to you again. Keep up the full steam ahead, David.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
I guess so stick around and get further details if you want to franchise a Butch Bakery, huh?
Butch Bakery
is around the world. I guess you never can tell. He was actually a lawyer on Wall Street.
Oh, that's right.
I guess there are plenty of casualties from Wall Street out there, including the guy with the lady with witch brownies, fat witch brownies.
Fat witch brownies,
And all kinds of interesting talents people realized they had when they found that they had to really work for a living.
They all seem to gravitate towards food. What a colorful cast of characters
don't they just?
We have to interview.
Well, anyway, we're finishing up today with some other career changers. And a sort of a love story and a family story as well. Oh, are we supposed to take a break? Well, I'll just get rid of that. And just reminded me that I got ahead of ourselves here and we forgot to take a break. So here's a break and we'll be right back after that.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, this is Peter, and I usually don't get to start these interviews, but I just couldn't resist saying that this product might have been called What the Butler Saw. but it's actually not. It's called It's Arthur's Fault, and I said it's usually Peter's fault, too. And we're going to go further in the interview along that direction, but back over to Anne.
Well, yes, we're talking to Arthur and Laurel Shelmandine, which is somebody sitting down to eat a platter of clams, right?
Yeah. Easy to remember.
But you don't know it, you two, but I've actually been following your company for a while because I was just so fascinated with the name and the story behind it.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. When did you start this?
Which iteration would be the question? The first time I started selling food was over 20 years ago as a side when I was being a stay-at-home dad part of the time and working at a ski area doing snowmaking the other part during the winter.
Uh-huh.
And one of the places that I frequented for lunch were other foodies, and they asked me to bring in some of my stuff, and so I started pairing foods for a deli, peanut satay sauce and soups and other things.
So you had been making these things in your home kitchen and probably giving them away for quite some time?
For a little while. The peanut satay sauce is the first product I sold. It is our best-selling product, and it came about through a very arduous series of events, starting with a separate life as a luggage and backpack designer in the late 70s, and we were doing a craft street fair on Wall Street.
Uh-huh.
And next to us was a Southeast Asian woman who was doing satay.
Uh-huh.
It was the first time I had it, fell in love with it. Of course, back then, nobody else had it, so I had to recreate it on my own, and it took me years to get it to the point where I liked it.
So you essentially, just to encompass the whole company, you do sauces, marinades, what else?
Rubs,
right.
And the sauces are barbecues and savory sauces. Marinades are also salad dressings, and we do vinaigrette, and we do caramels and hot fudge.
Yeah, well, the hot fudge is the one Peter's eyeing up.
I don't know. We used the greeny sauce the other night.
Yeah, we did.
And oh, the Vermonster.
Yeah, the Vermonster.
Yeah, we put that on some zucchini and sort of baked and broiled it in the oven, and it turned out really nice.
Yeah, I also spooned some of it directly into the
Oh, you did? Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was another product that had a long beginning until it got to where I was happy with it and conceptualized it as something else, and then it kind of morphed into what it is.
Now, let's go back to the name, because the name's intriguing, and we know Arthur part. The felt part we haven't come to yet.
Well, the very quick answer is that Arthur and I were once very thin, and we're not.
That's what I thought, but I wanted you to say that. I didn't think it was appropriate for me to say that.
And the family has always blamed me for cooking too well that they can't stop eating, and so they would limit times of visiting, and the Christmas package of hot fudge and homemade truffles and caramels would be devoured. And there's also the other background to the story is that I'm the fourth Arthur in the family, and so not only was it my fault, but it was also my father's fault, my grandfather's fault.
That's
so great. It was a common kind of joke that just kind of expounded.
Back to talking about the business things that we do, in addition to the sauces, Arthur also teaches cooking classes. And on every December, we run 10 to 12 iterations of his holiday truffle making class.
Oh, wow.
And people come for the day, and they leave with 8 to 10 pounds of luscious truffles and turtles and caramels and bark.
Wow.
But every class, whatever the handout is, Arthur several years ago started putting on the recipe packet that the management assumes no responsibility for weight gain as a result of this class.
Now, did you envision, I'm assuming, Laurel, that you were not a foodie to start with?
Oh, I was. And 35 years ago, I fell in love with Arthur because he prepared peach crepe flambé for me.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The English expression for that is cupboard love, I think. I've never heard anybody in the U.S. use that term, so it may be exclusively English.
Yeah, it's not anything I know.
Okay,
about.
There you go. So now
I like it, though. I think we have to adopt that one.
I think you can have it by all means.
But now you did something else too, didn't you, Laurel?
Yes, and I am not as experimental a cook as Arthur by any means, but I have been a baker all of my life. My family ran concerts and festivals in the folk music genre, and I would often be pairing meals for 20, 30, 40 people who were at our house for a weekend. So we both are foodies. But the reason Arthur was a stay-at-home dad is because I built a career in healthcare consultation around very large medical systems at academic medical centers. And we had an incredible 3-year relocation to San Francisco from 96 to 99, when we came back, we bought this house that we're in now with the vision of Arthur finally being able to put in his dream kitchen, and with our daughters being at an age where he could begin to have a slightly less constant role in their care. It was the time to really seriously move this into a business. He'd come up with the label as a joke a few years before that for Christmas gifts, and we said, well, we have that part down, and in 2000, we'd finished the renovations, and we incorporated and started our business.
Well, you're in good company in Vermont. I mean, half the people we interview live in Vermont. I mean, artisanal cheesemakers and chocolatiers and you name it.
It's a wonderful place.
Yes. Are you close to any of these other people?
Quite a few.
And what about the goat cheese lady? I love her. The one who's the...
the caramel?
Oh, I know her. We've interviewed her, yeah. Yeah, but the other one is the book agent in Manhattan who inadvertently bought a farm, and then she had it populated with goats, and now she's winning prizes for her cheese.
It's called Consider Bardwell.
No, don't know her.
Don't know them. Well, you should find them. I'm sure Consider Bardwell will let you find them, and she's a really intriguing person.
You can do some
nice trades. We may have met at the Cheesemakers Festival.
Festival. Okay. So, yeah, we have so much
cheese. Have you folks come up to that event?
No, I can't remember why. There was some reason we didn't make that. We've been invited, and I think it was the timing, but I don't remember why. And there's apparently a narrow window for when you get between the ice and the snow and the mud, right?
No, and then come the flies.
And then come the flies.
Then come the black flies.
Yes.
Now let's give your website and tell people how they can get your products.
It's www.itsarthursfault.com. No hyphens, no spaces, no apostrophes.
Okay, and you do have probably a store locator?
Yes, and we're at 40-plus stores throughout Vermont, a couple in upstate New York, and in the Boston area.
And can people order off the website?
They can, and we've shipped all over the world.
Oh, that's great.
And you're adding new products regularly? Or?
Yes, we are.
Not as often as he thinks of them, but...
I'm sure not. Yeah, we need to come and hang out with you guys.
We would love that. We do 5 or 6 farmers markets a week from May through October, or we take part in them. And I can't tell you how many times two things happen. The first is that we have people who stop and take photographs of the sign of our name.
Yes.
And we always know that they know someone who's an Arthur.
Yes.
And we talk to them about that. But the other is people say, I want to come to your house for dinner.
That's exactly sort of what I had in mind.
Yes.
your name actually rang a bell of something else that was so intriguing to me when we were in Adelaide, Australia, that I took a picture of it. It was called the Smelly Cheese Shop.
Very good.
So anyhow, well, keep us posted with your new products. What's the total number you have now?
24?
I believe with the rubs we're up to 27.
Well, you're busy
people. We added
people.
This past year, the 3 rubs, the Mayan hot fudge sauce, which I adore, and the Vermonster.
Yeah, well, the Vermonster, I really loved, yeah.
Yeah, we tried that one. We have a friend who loves to make satay chicken.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we're probably going to make a gift of the satay to him.
Well, we're going to do a deal.
Oh, we're going to do a deal. Okay, we're going to do a deal. Well, it's always going to be a deal. It's a fascinating, a truly charming story, and thank you so much for joining us all the way from Vermont.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, and keep in touch.
We will.
It's nice to know that it's somebody else's fault than Peter's. There you go. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us today's program. We hope you enjoyed it and that you'll join us again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.